to the sixth case this morning, United States v. Richmond.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, I'm going to be very brief. I think the facts in this case were very straightforward. This involved a stop and frisk in front of the federal courthouse in Peoria. All the parties were, of course, very familiar with the scene. The record is probably a little bit ambiguous in spots because we were so familiar with the layout and where everything happened.
So we should check out Google Maps or something.
We didn't have to make a map in the courtroom.
All these bars in the vicinity of the federal courthouse where at 4 a.m. closing times?
There are a line of bars on either side of the courthouse. And there were 4 o'clock liquor licenses. That's why at 3:30...
Urbana, too, I think.
No,
the same is true in New Albany, Indiana, as well. So.
No, I think Peoria is pretty unique in that. There are a number of caverns. There's a strip joint across the bar, from the courthouse. But anyway, there were very few facts that the government marshaled in support of its reasonable suspicion for the stop and frisk. If there were a test that you take the evidence in a light most favorable to the government, well, the case would be closed. But that's not the test. What we need to do is examine the totality of the circumstances, take the facts that were presented, take the rational inferences that you could draw from them, and then conclude whether the person was armed and or dangerous. And I would submit in this case that there was not such a reasonable suspicion. What we had was a man walking in front of the courthouse, officer driving in the opposite way, 4 to 5 men. The defendant stopped. He turned and he faced the front of the courthouse. For 15 seconds, the officer said. When he turned around, he said he noticed a bulge in his waistband. The officer then turned around the corner and stopped. There's a line of newspaper boxes that basically obstructed his view. He then asked the defendant to come to him. Now, he couldn't see the man for a period of time until he came out from behind the boxes and he was right at his squad car. At that time, he didn't see the bulge. Now, here's what's interesting. He lets the man, the officer rolled down the passenger window of the squad, asked the man for his name and his date of birth, and then let him stand there while he ran his name on a mobile data terminal, and then waited for the response, presumably while he's still seat-belted in his squad car. Now, the officer testified that he believed that the man was armed and dangerous at that point. Now, why in the world would he let the defendant come up to him in that manner if he believed he was armed and dangerous? And why wouldn't he call for backup? Why wouldn't he even let his dispatcher know where he was? Now, he had an answer for all those things. But that's the interesting part, because it's easy for an officer, once he's found something, to then go back with 20/20 hindsight and take and cherry pick all the little unusual things that he noticed and then marshal those into a reasonable suspicion finding. Now, that's what he did here. But he also, in fact, in his police report, when he documented this incident, those very important facts weren't even in it. For instance,
this all sounds like a great argument to the district court on the credibility of the officer. How does it help you on appeal?
Because the totality of the circumstances is what's left out of this. The inferences that you can draw from those facts were not really examined by the district court, in my opinion.
Well, he did point out the things that he left out of his police report.
He did. He certainly did. He chastised the officer while he was testifying and also while he was ruling.
But nevertheless, he credited him that he was telling the truth and believed it.
He did, and I'm not challenging those facts today. But I am challenging the rational inferences that could be drawn from those facts.
Well, you know, you start out, my main thing looking at it is 2:25 a.m. If it was 2:25 in the afternoon, you might have a different ballgame.
Well, it was actually 3:25 in the morning.
Even worse.
But there were 4 a.m. liquor licenses, people downtown. It was not an unusual thing for people to be walking on the sidewalks. And when the officer said he saw a bulge in his waistband, couldn't it have been just as easily an open container of alcohol that the defendant was trying to hide? Not a weapon.
I thought he testified that it had the shape of a handle of a weapon.
Mm-hmm. He said he testified that it had the shape of the handle of a weapon. In fact, the prosecutor asked the officer after he actually was on redirect examination. He said, "Now, officer, the firearm that you found, is there anything about that is consistent with what you say you saw earlier?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, the handle of the weapon." Now,
okay.
Well, what he's doing is he's essentially taking what he's found and then backing up.
Well, I understand the point, but it's a credibility argument, isn't it?
It is a credibility argument. The officer says he saw the handle of a weapon. How can that be challenged except to show what he actually did? His actions speak louder than his words. When you know that he let this man who has a gun supposedly in his waistband walk up to his squad and interact with him when he's a sitting duck in his squad car and doesn't bother to call for backup. And then when his record check comes back, no record on file, he uses that as a suspicious circumstance, even though 4 minutes after he frisked the defendant and found the weapon, he ran that name again. He ran it again with the same date of birth and the correct name of the defendant, testified that it could have been his mistake when he ran the name the first time, but then says it was suspicious when he ran it because it came back clear. Everybody has a state ID, he said. So he basically took a fact that at the time he realized could have been his mistake and tried to draw some sinister inference from it at the suppression hearing. That's my point. So, Your Honor, if you look at it from the totality of the circumstances, you don't look at it by cherry-picking the few facts that appeared to be suspicious and then assume nothing else in the case. If you do that, then you should be able to find that there was an inspired hunch that there was a gun and not something else. There are no other questions. I'll reserve rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Alvarado. Mr. Hartzler.
Thank you again. I can lower the podium if there are questions from the court, but it's obvious you're familiar with the facts of the case, and we really do just have a credibility issue. So I will thank you. If there are no questions, I'll
thank you,
back the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else, Mr. Armaro? Well, thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.